Stephen D. Rankin against Commonwealth, Mr. Broccoletti and Ms. Tyson.
Morning, Your Honor.
And Mr. Watt.
And this is Ms. Belote, who will be glad to answer any questions that the court has, correct? May it please the court, my name is James Broccoletti. We represent Mr. Stephen Rankin before this court on an appeal of a conviction for voluntary manslaughter. There are two issues that were raised in the petition.
Excuse me, would you like to reserve any time?
I apologize, Your Honor. Yes, sir.
No, you don't have to apologize. You don't have to reserve it. We'll use it all if you'd like.
3 minutes, please.
3 minutes. All right. Thank you. Glad to hear from you.
There are two issues that were raised before the court in the petition, and I'd like to start with the exclusion of Michael Lyman as the expert witness. The court...
Let me interrupt you about that, and we're familiar with the record. What would it be? What's the relevance of an opinion regarding the use of force policies of any police department, whether it's Portsmouth or other national police departments? Isn't the issue whether the law permitted the degree of force used, as opposed to whether some departmental policy? I mean, you could be fired for violating a departmental policy, but it's not necessarily a shield to being prosecuted, is it?
No one says it was a shield, and that was not the argument. The argument was not that that is the law of Virginia. The jury was going to be instructed on what self-defense was. The jury was going to be instructed.
What was the point of it? I mean, what?
Well, the point was, understand the backdrop, okay, in terms, with respect to the issues that were introduced before the court. Assistant Chief Wilson had already testified from the Portsmouth Police Department. She had already introduced the use of force, the general policy, I think it's Defense Exhibit 5. She commented upon that. So the document was already into evidence.
Second, those were defense
correct.
Document and defense witness, correct?
Correct. So the issue was already before the jury. It's not as if it came out of the blue and Mr. Lyman was...
Well, the issue of whether that should have been admitted is not before us.
That's correct. But since it was admitted, and then the second part of the equation is the cross-examination that the Commonwealth's attorney did of Mr. Rankin. She extensively cross-examined him, I count at least 7 to 8 times in the record, beginning on page 312 all the way through page 338. I apologize. She extensively cross-examined him on the record about how his actions either comported with or did not comport with the Portsmouth use of force policy in the general order. So she interjected the issues themselves. Why didn't you use OC spray? Why didn't you use MMA? Why didn't you use UFC? Why didn't you fight him and take him to the ground? All of those issues she introduced before the jury through her cross-examination, which occurred before Mr. Lyman testified. So with that backdrop, all of those issues were swirling in the court. There were all issues that the jury was going to have to determine in terms of what...
But I guess my question, and it's just a question, I'm not sure what the answer at this point is, but...
Well, I hope I can give it to you. Well,
you'll give me an answer, I'm sure, whether it's the right one or not, I guess remains to be seen. But the if irrelevant evidence is admitted without objection, at what point do we, if ever, do you draw the line and say, you know, we're going down a road here that just doesn't matter? It's, you know, whether you follow a policy manual of a law enforcement agency is not the issue. That may be the issue at a disciplinary hearing or something, but how is it ever going to be the issue as to whether the use of a force was appropriate from a legal standpoint?
And perhaps if the court had excluded Ms. Wilson, if the court had excluded the defense exhibit, if the court had sustained objections to the Commonwealth Attorney's questions of the defendant on his following that policy and his use of force, then perhaps Your Honor would be correct in that regard because we'd be operating on a blank slate. But you can't ignore what's already happened. You can't ignore all the facts and circumstances that have occurred. You can't ignore all the issues that have been put before the jury with respect to the document itself, the testimony of the chief, but most importantly, the cross-examination of the defendant when the specific issues of why didn't you do this, and do this, and his answers were, well, because this is the way we're trained, and this is our use of force continuum, and this is the general order. So those issues were before the jury to determine his reasonableness, his fear of bodily harm, whether he acted with sufficient force, whether he acted with greater force. All of those issues were before the jury at that point, and so Mr. Lyman follows through on that at the end to wrap it all up and to explain it to the jury, and that's why it's relevant.
All right, so in assuming it's relevant from the standpoint of the context of the cross and whatever, explain to me, if you can, the relevance of what other police departments are doing and how that bears on anything really with respect to Virginia law.
Well, it was a combination. There was a multiple, during the proffer that I
right.
made, there were multiple issues that I wanted to raise with him and examine with him. That was one of them, whether or not the force was standard throughout the country. Not that Portsmouth was some rogue jurisdiction and had just this policy that nobody else had adopted. I think that's significant because it fits within
the
norm.
Well, isn't it important, though, from the standpoint of, I mean, for example, I don't know if Los Angeles might have been one of these cities that he was going to opine about, but California might have a different legal standard for the use of force than Virginia does.
Correct, and he would have been able to say that and explain that if it did.
But how is any of that relevant, though,
to it's relevant to the just issue? In the context of setting the reasonableness of their policy and then the defendant following that policy.
But the reasonableness of the policy, the legal reason is, I'm sorry, the reasonableness of the policy is not a jury question.
It's not a jury question, but it's an issue that was introduced in the court.
And I guess that's what troubles me is because at some point it seems to me the whole point of an expert is to assist the jury, not to confuse the jury. And at some point it seems to me you run the risk of getting into so many extraneous issues that really don't bear on the ultimate issue of guilt or innocence under the law of the Commonwealth of Virginia, that the use of the expert, you know, has the opposite effect from what it's intended to.
But that's the point. He wasn't there to confuse or mislead. He was there to explain and to clear up any issues that may have been addressed.
Well, counsel, on that point, the judge did give wide latitude for questioning this individual, correct?
Well, that's an interesting point, Judge Decker, because in effect, the judge said, you're not going to be able to testify as an expert, but then let me call him and ask him questions that were expert opinions, which I think clearly demonstrated that the court misapplied the legal standard as to what an expert was. The judge said on page 202 of the appendix, he goes, I'm not going to let him testify because we're getting kind of close to the ultimate fact. Kind of close counts in horseshoes and hand grenades. It doesn't count in the rules of court. The rules of court don't say kind of close. It's whether he invades the ultimate issue of fact, which is why I positioned the questions as being, is he consistent with or inconsistent with, which is what we do every day in drug cases, sane nurses, as we pointed out in our brief. So the questions weren't designed to get to the ultimate issue of fact, which were still going to be allowed to be presented to the jury for them to make the determination as the fact finder. But the court completely misapplied what the standards were.
Hypothetically, can you violate the Portsmouth Police Department's use of force policies and not be guilty of use of excessive force if you violate those policies?
I've seen the juries do everything.
No, I mean, just I'm asking a legal hypothetical question, not what juries do in an abstract situation. But
I'm sure you could.
Okay, and is the opposite true then?
I'm sure you could do that too.
Then again, I guess get back to how helpful is it to a jury to have all these use of force policies from Portsmouth and other places injected into a trial when the only issue is under the specific facts and circumstances of this shoplifting situation, did Officer Rankin, you know, exceed the appropriate use of force that the circumstances dictated for that particular situation from a reasonableness standard?
Again, given the fact that the use of force continuum was in evidence already, the fact that he would have been consistent with his use of force, again, affects what the jury's determination of the entire issue of the entire case would be. Because they could say that, yes, you acted reasonably within this, and so therefore you're still guilty of voluntary manslaughter, or not.
We've been beating you up about this. I want to make sure you get to your other issue
right.
as well. So
I will, but I guess the point that I'm trying to make is if the court reads the cross, which I'm sure the court has, and the court sees how many times the Commonwealth's attorney focused on what the defendant did and why he didn't do all of these other issues, all these OC spray, MMA, UFC, all these things, all of which are not contained with that. Mr. Lyman, who I think is an expert, and I think the court allowed him to testify as an expert, would have been able to say the defendant's would have been able to counteract that. That was evidence that we would have been able to introduce in our favor, which would have, I'd submit to the court, bolstered the credibility and the testimony of the defendant. All right, with respect to the second issue, and I thought about this yesterday.
You did a lot of preparation, did you?
Well, it was a long day yesterday, Judge Humphreys. But no, you think about this case, and you miss the forest or the trees sometimes. As I was looking at the video, it probably dawned on me, you don't know who the parties were. Who, if in fact we were able to adequately describe to you.
We figured it out.
Yeah,
okay.
I was going to say we kind of could sense who was who.
So I apologize if the brief wasn't more accurate with respect to that. And I'm sure the court has reviewed the video very carefully with respect to that. In this particular case, there are several issues that we raised in our, the brief. First of all, the court under Evan is under an obligation to investigate a circumstance of any jury contact whatsoever. And that investigation, Evan says, and this is on page 5 of 7, in conducting such an investigation, the trial judge may summon jurors and persons knowledgeable of the evidence to be, quote, sworn in open court and duly examined by the court and counsel as to what transpired, close quote.
That's neither, May, right?
May, correct. The court didn't do that. The court didn't swear in.
But the court's not required to do that. That's our emphasis on May.
I understand that, but I'm suggesting to the court that any investigation which consists of two questions, what's your name and what you heard, without being sworn, is insufficient. Followed up by, as Evan itself points out, once the court hears the discrepancies in this testimonies because they weren't sworn, in the statements made by Ms. James, and do you know that's her name? We don't know that's her name. Her name could be Susie Jones for all we know. Once the court heard the discrepancies with respect to that witness and the juror, then the court was obligated to conduct further examinations and further inquiries in that.
Counsel, as far as the, at this juncture, for an appellate court, what is the standard on this, in terms of on this issue?
Well, I think it's an abuse of discretion as to whether or not the court did a complete investigation and whether there was sufficient jury tamper. But I think that the Commonwealth, once we have shown that there has been contact between a third party and the juror, the Commonwealth bears the heavy burden of showing that that's innocuous.
Now, well, actually, Reiner says it a little differently. Reiner only says that there's presumptive prejudice if the contact with the juror is involves tampering or private communication concerning the trial.
Correct.
And here the record we have indicates that both parties to this conversation indicate no discussion whatsoever about the facts or the evidence presented at the trial. And given that, if the presumption doesn't apply, isn't it your burden then I don't see any burden by the Commonwealth under Reiner in the absence of evidence of presumptive prejudice.
This court in Stevenson versus Commonwealth, the Supreme Court, Stevenson versus Commonwealth, 218 Virginia 462, said, nonverbal conduct of a person is a statement if it is intended as an assertion. So her presence, her conduct, her let me talk to you for a minute. Her dapping him and hitting him with their elbows or whatever it is that they did when they walked through the gate. Them walking down that hallway alone in a hallway that was different and taking an elevator that was different than any other jurors had ever taken before during the course of the trial is a statement because it's an assertion. She is telling him, I am with the family, I am with you, you are with me. That's a statement.
How do you read that from the record?
You look at the video.
We did.
We
okay.
Did.
And so, and look at what they said. Her testimony, her statement, page 374, the judge says, what happened? We came through the door, we were coming through the gate. We weren't coming through the gate. That juror 16 went through the gate, was getting dressed, and was going to the other elevator with the other jurors. I saw a young man that I knew, and I said, good morning. She didn't say good morning. She said, psst, psst. Wait here a minute. I need to talk to you.
Could she not have said good morning after she said psst, psst?
She could have, but that's not what Juror 16 said she said. He contradicts that altogether on page 376 and 377 of the appendix. He does say she said psst, psst, and I turned around. The judge says, you had a conversation. I told her I was doing my civic duty. What did she tell you? She didn't say good morning. She said she was here to see somebody. Contrast that with what she said. page 375, she said, I'm here for a trial. What are you doing here? So there's a complete discrepancy in what the two people have said. They're not under oath. They tell different stories. And under Evan, at that point, the court has a much greater obligation for it to be involved in an investigation.
Well, there's certainly some discrepancies in their stories, but the one thing that appears in both stories is that there was no discussion about the trial at all, other than, what are you here for? I'm here for a trial. Oh, me too. That, you know, words to that effect.
Well, why don't we find out what her name is? Why don't we put her under oath? Why don't we find out where she lives?
I'll grant all that, but none of that, all of that is speculation. And in the absence of evidence that there's been some sort of tampering, we assume, and the law is pretty clear on this, I'll suggest to you, Mr. Broccoletti, we assume jurors follow the instructions of law. And here the instructions were pretty clear. The court gave repeatedly throughout the trial not to discuss the case, not to, you know, watch TV or get their information from anywhere outside the courtroom. And the fact that they happened to be acquainted certainly, you know, is not the usual situation, but in the absence of it being any more than that, what are we supposed to do?
Juries convict on that evidence every day. You're given jury instructions about circumstantial evidence, credibility of the witnesses, demeanor of the witnesses. They are instructed on that every day, and they convict beyond a reasonable doubt on that evidence every day. The evidence that you have in terms of the discrepancies between the two parties, the evidence that you, and again, she doesn't have to say to him, hey, find him guilty, throw this trial, fry him, like they said in Stockton. She doesn't have to say that. That's the point that I'm trying to make. Her presence with the family through the entire trial, the court didn't even exclude her. He let her sit with the family after she knew the juror, after the juror had made contact with her, after the juror walks into that jury box and sees her sitting with the family right in that courtroom. The court didn't even do that. So when you look at that context, she doesn't have to say a word to him. All she has to do is present herself with that family, present herself to him, and that message is clear. And this is during deliberation. It's not where we can exclude a juror. It's not where we can bring an alternate in. We don't have that ability. It's the most sacred time of the trial, during deliberations. Thank you.
Ms. Tice?
Good morning. May it please the court, I would like to talk about the expert issue first, because I think I need to make a few corrections to what Mr. Broccoletti said. First of all, the defense introduced that policy over the objection of the Commonwealth. The Commonwealth objected that the policy should not come in because it would the jury would be misguided, they would be confused, and the court let it in because the defense offered it and the court let it in. Secondly, Mr. Lyman testified prior to the defendant testifying. Mr. Lyman, the voir dire with regard to his qualifications was in the 190s. He testified as a fact witness from 204 to about 208. Mr. Rankin's testimony is much later. I also feel that it's important for me to respond to counsel's argument with regard to the Commonwealth's cross-examination of the defendant and how she was asking him all these questions about the policy. Well, the policy's already in, and the defendant already testified about the policy, and I think it's very interesting that at pages 259 to 260, it was not the Commonwealth's attorney who asked this question, it was defense counsel who asked the question. Why didn't you tackle him? Why didn't you punch him? Why didn't you have some physical contact with him? Yes, this was the issue. The cross-examination by the Commonwealth's attorney was not beyond the scope, because the defendant had already testified with regard to
Ms. Tyson, let me interrupt you and ask you this question. I gather from your, although you haven't stated it out loud, I gather your position is that that none of this is relevant. Now, the trial court ultimately cut the expert off on the grounds that he was going to the ultimate issue, and I'm not sure anybody could seriously argue that that was the case. So is this a right result, wrong reason kind of analysis, or
it,
what?
It can be, Your Honor, but let me suggest this. If, in fact, and we don't have the opening statement or the closing arguments prepared in this case, if, in fact, the defense was conflating the policy with self-defense law, if the defense was replacing the law of self-defense with this policy, then it definitely does go to the ultimate issue. Improperly so, but it would be the ultimate issue. However, if, as counsel argues today, it wasn't replacing self-defense, then it's not relevant. So either way, the court did not err and certainly did not abuse its discretion in not permitting expert testimony about a policy. And the policy, in fact, was in evidence because the defense introduced it. It was introduced through Assistant Chief Wilson. And she agreed at page 188 of the appendix that this did not supersede self-defense law. And interestingly, if you look at this policy, which is in the appendix at 423 to, I think, about 429, the part of it says that these are guidelines necessary to protect themselves or other persons from bodily harm, to maintain public order, or to effect an investigative detention arrest of an individual. So this policy is not just limited to someone protecting himself. The trial court admitted this policy upon the request of the defense, and the Commonwealth objected. The judge said, I'm going to instruct them properly on self-defense. And instructions 10 through 14 do precisely that. So the jury had before them the proper consideration of self-defense law.
Well, I understand Mr. Broccoli's argument essentially to be, yes, but the judge let it in, therefore I should be allowed to expand upon it.
Well, Your Honor, I would disagree with that because the jury had the policy. They could see it. There was tremendous testimony about what it required and what it didn't through Assistant Chief Wilson, the defendant himself, with regard to whether you had to go through every level or not, and the testimony was that that was not required depending upon the circumstances that presented themselves. And so there was not a need for expert testimony. The policy was what it was, and the jury had it, and it was not replacing the law on self-defense. Now, with regard to Lyman's testimony as a fact witness, and his fact witness, his testimony was with regard to some practices that were not in the policy, but they were factual. Why is it that, describe center mass. It was an explanation that center mass is the torso, and that's where a shot would be taken, the double tap. That it would be two shots, that an officer would not empty his gun, and then the cuffing of a victim of a shooting because without medical knowledge, you wouldn't know whether that person still could cause a danger.
Is that, in effect, expert testimony, as Mr. Broccoletti suggests?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because it's simply the factual basis of some practices. And the court did provide tremendous leeway in letting Dr. Lyman testify to this. And actually, that does bring up another point that I argued on brief, and I will only touch on it briefly here, which is that the other things that the defense brought up at the proffer, the 21-foot rule, the distances that one would lunge, and the refusal to tackle, he didn't bring those up to the court until the actual proffer. And the reason why there's a default here is because given the fact that the trial judge permitted such wide leeway with these factual matters, there's certainly every reason to believe that the judge would have considered these other things, but he didn't bring those up to the judge, and this court should not consider those as well. And so
your point is he could have asked those questions.
It's possible that he could have. He didn't ask the judge if he could ask those questions. When the defendant asked the judge, well, can you at least let him testify about the center mass, double tap, and cuffing, the judge said, yes, I'm going to let you testify to those. The judge didn't have the opportunity to rule on these other things that had been brought up on appeal. And so, again, I think that there is a way that it could have been ultimate issue depending upon what the arguments were with regard to this policy replacing self-defense. But as a matter of law, self-defense was the jury was properly instructed on self-defense, and this was not something that was relevant and certainly not something that was necessarily the subject of expert testimony. So the trial judge did not abuse his discretion in ruling that this expert could not testify with regard to whether the Portsmouth policy met the national standard and whether the defendant followed it. By the way, the defendant testified at 321 that he did follow the the policy. So this was before the jury, and thus, I guess, in summing up on the first issue, I would say that it is our position that there was no error, but certainly, if there was any error, it is harmless, given all of the evidence that the jury heard with regard to these policies. So I would like to turn now to the jury issue. And as I think it came out during the argument before, that the judge constantly reminded this jury, and I think the most pertinent time that the judge had, I think it was maybe 52 or 53 of the appendix, where the judge says, don't discuss this, don't allow yourself to be within the hearing of a discussion. Of course, I think the other really important piece that we have is that the trial judge instructed the jurors that if they were asked what they were doing, they should say they were here doing their civic duty, which, by the way, is precisely what the juror told Ms. James. That was his answer to the court. Now, with regard to swearing in the juror and the spectator, I think it's important that the trial judge, in this case, very promptly conducted an investigation when this came to his attention. You can see that in the record, beginning in, actually this entire issue was covered between pages 373 and 404 of the appendix. The Captain Lilly points out the spectator, the judge questions her, they go to the conference room and question the juror, then he allows Captain Lilly to come and provide some hearsay testimony and some testimony about what he saw in the videos.
But what is the significance of what defense counsel alluded to with regard to the disparity in the testimony between the juror and the...
Your Honor, there was some disparity between their testimony, but it's not so significant. I dare say that if their statements were precisely the same, then we would have maybe a different concern. But what we do have is the spectator, Ms. James, who said that she had greeted someone that she knew and that she asked him what he was doing there. He told her he was there for the trial, and she said that she told him that she was there for a trial too. Now that's a little different from what he said. The juror said that she had told him she was there to see someone. But what's important, most important here, is that nobody disputes there was some contact. You can't look at the seven videotapes and dispute that there was some contact. But both the juror and the spectator provide information that they didn't talk about this case. And in fact, the juror is asked again, and this is at 377, after he testifies that he told her he was doing his civic duty. And the judge says, but you didn't talk about the case. He said, no, not a thing. And the videotapes don't dispute that. Yes, she saw him and she made some sort of sound. I think everybody agrees there was a psst. And you can watch the video and the juror stands there as she comes through. And they walk down the hall. Even Captain Lilly said he didn't know whether the touching of the elbow was inadvertent or not. He didn't know if this was innocent. He felt that he should bring it to the court's attention. And the court promptly investigated. And the court then, in addition to initially questioning both the juror and the spectator, said to the defense, and you can bring this back up if you want. And the defense does bring it back up. And the defense says, well, how in the world could the juror not know she was a spectator and vice versa? And the prosecutor offered an explanation and said, because of the logistics of the courtroom, it's possible that she didn't see him or vice versa. And the response from the defense isn't, well, that's crazy. No, that can't be true. There is no response to that. And we do have one video from the courtroom, but we really can't know where everybody was sitting from the video. But there is no dispute of that avowal by the prosecutor. Instead, the defense focuses on whether she took a different elevator or left the courthouse. And the court's question was, did she take a different elevator? And the answer is yes. Now that is video number 5. And I think it's kind of interesting because in video number 5, you see the juror get off. He's riding the elevator with an officer and the prosecutor. And then, I thought I was being really, really technically savvy. It's 17 seconds later, you see it come out. But if you look at the counter, it actually is a longer period of time. I don't know whether the time of day counter is accurate or not. But from the video, it would appear it was a pretty short period of time. And on page 375 of the appendix, there is the statement from the spectator that something to the effect of she went around, came back around, and took a different elevator. The fact of the matter is she took a different elevator when she realized that this was a juror in the case where
it was actually the same elevator, but later.
It looks like it from the video that it is.
And it was the same elevator, but it was later. But would a reasonable interpretation be another elevator just means not the same elevator as the juror?
She did not ride, and that was the judge's question. Does she ride the same elevator as the juror?
At the same time.
And the answer was no. And really, the critical legal issue here is Remmer. And yes, Stockton and Barnes and Scott, we cited those cases.
What about Mr. Broccoletti's point about the burden? Whose burden is it when and where at the trial level?
Yes, and the burden becomes the Commonwealth's burden when you meet the two-prong test of Remmer that Reiner and Lenz and some of these other cases have adopted. And that is when you have a contact and that there's evidence that contact is about the matter that is pending before the jury. And that is the phrase that is used again and again. I started out in Remmer, that it was that phrase. As opposed to what we have from some of the federal cases that refer to an innocuous intervention. And that's all the evidence that we have here. I think I've got...
Similar to asking for a cigarette?
Well, or discussing the weather, as in, I think both of those things happened in the Carter case that this court recently decided. I think I got a little far afield with about the sworn in, and I want to jump back to that and say that the court was conducting its investigation of the juror and the spectator. And there are numerous times when the court says, anything else? Anything? Anything else? And the defense had an opportunity if felt that this investigation was not done properly because there was a lack of swearing, to ask the court to do it. And I realize in his reply brief, he indicated, well, it was the court's investigation. And that is true. But he certainly could have asked the court to do any number of things that he didn't do. And he didn't ask that they be sworn in. He didn't ask the court to look at the videotapes. He didn't renew his motion for a mistrial after he brought some additional information to the court. And so the burden becomes the Commonwealth when you have both prongs that have been brought forth for the court's attention. The fact of the matter is this court conducted the investigation. The fact of the matter is that this court did not abuse its discretion in either issue, and we would urge this court to affirm the judgment from the Portsmouth Circuit Court.
As we pointed out in our brief, a trial court by definition abuses its discretion when it makes an error of law. The abuse of discretion standard includes review to determine that the discretion was not guided by erroneous legal conclusions. You all walk outside and you ask somebody, what's a double tap? What's a mass center shooting? Why do you handcuff a subject after he's been shot? Those aren't matters of general knowledge. Those are matters within the purview of officers trained and experts. And therefore, the court allowed those questions to be asked of Mr. Lyman in an expert opinions way, but yet declined on other issues. So therefore, our position with respect to that is this is not an abuse of discretion standard for the court to review, because the court made an error of law in judging he just got it wrong. He got it wrong. And as Judge Humphrey says, these questions don't come close to invading the province of the jury. With respect to the juror question or the juror tampering, how many times do we also tell jurors you don't leave your common sense at the door? You don't leave your common sense when you walk into the courtroom. Jurors sit in the box. Your honors take the bench. You saw the video. You saw, and I don't know what this woman's name. She said it was Miss James. It could be anything. Nobody ever asked her. Judge didn't ask her. What's your
name? How does that matter?
Well, it matters because how is that an investigation? How is that a proper investigation if you can't even be sure that the person you're talking to is giving you the correct name? How can you make any credibility decisions, especially then when you follow it up?
Well, how do you respond to Ms. Tyson's point that you could have asked the judge to pursue further lines of inquiry?
He didn't give me a chance. You look at page 375 of the record, he asked her two questions. It goes from 374 to 375. She said, I went around, I came back, I took the opposite elevator. and I came through the side. All right, you may be seated. Didn't give us a chance. Didn't say, counsel, do you have any questions? Counsel, would you like to inquire? Same thing with juror 16, found on page 378.
But you would agree, though, that you didn't ask for an opportunity to inquire.
I do, but my position is that the court didn't give us that. It's the court's obligation to instruct the jurors on the law. We all agree on that. The court has an affirmative obligation, despite what counsel may do, and the law is very clear on that, to instruct jurors on what the applicable law is. Here, the court has an obligation to the defendant to provide a fair trial by conducting a complete and thorough investigation, not counsel's obligation. And the court never gave us that opportunity. With respect to juror 16 on page 378, the judge says, thank you for your honesty. Yes, sir. All right, thank you. Take him back. That's it.
What about when there was a discussion about going to confer with co-counsel and the defendant?
Well, that's when we had to make the decision about whether to move for the mistrial at that point. Obviously, I had to get the defendant's position with respect to that once we heard what the evidence was. But my point about the common sense is when you look, I know I've passed my time, just a minute.
Sure.
When you look at the video and you look at the end of the video and you see the spectator, distinct in her appearance as she was the entire trial. And she walks down that hallway. They go to that elevator, they go into that vestibule. She then pops out of that vestibule, and what does she do? She doesn't pop out and walk down the hallway. She pops out and she looks around the corner, and she looks around the corner, and she looks around the corner, and then she goes back into the elevator, then she comes out, and then she leaves. That's common sense. That tells you what her intent was. That tells you what her purpose was. She doesn't have to say to him, hey, you need to throw this case. Her presence, her demeanor, and her conduct conveys words, and that's an assertion, and that's a statement. And as Evan said on page 6 at the bottom, we further hold that the trial judge failed to satisfy his affirmative duty to adequately investigate the juror misconduct allegation. And then it goes on, when the court found out that there's conflicts in what those statements were. We have conflicts as the court concedes and as the government concedes. And the court failed in its investigation. Thank you for giving me the time.
Thank you, Mr. Broccoletti. We will come down to Greek Council and take up the last case of the day, Alfred Darnell Lane against...